Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 31st of July 2007. It's a cold, clear winter day here in Sydney. We'd like to welcome people who are joining us from around the world via live streaming at the 2GLF website. And remember, you can also listen back to this show at our website, www.dadsontheair.net. The website is a bit clunky at the moment. We're redesigning it, so please bear with us. We'll be fashionable one day soon. In the studio, we have Ian Purdy.
Good morning, John.
We have Peter Vanderford.
Morning, John. Pop,
and myself, John Stapleton. We've got an interesting show coming up this morning. The first interview is with Peter Saunders. He's a senior researcher at the Centre for Independent Studies, and he'll be speaking about Australia's astonishingly high levels of addiction to welfare. His basic thesis being that under the Howard government, there's been a massive ballooning of welfare budgets. He's written two books on the subject, Australia's Welfare Habit, How to Kick It, and the latest tome from him is called The Government Giveth and The Government Taketh Away. It should be a very interesting interview. He's been a guest on this program before, and he's great talent. Almost all Australian families now have a relationship with the government through Centrelink and family payments, and as far as he's concerned, as far as many of us are concerned, we'd all be better off if the government just left us alone and stopped taxing us at these outrageously draconian levels just to give the money back in ways which Howard and the rest of his ilk thinks will make us vote for them. Not much chance of that, looking at the latest polls, with Australia's Conservative government facing annihilation at the elections due later this year. Anyone who wants to know why an air of decay and deceit is adhering to a dying Howard government need only look at their appalling treatment of separated fathers and the way that they promised, essentially promised, that they would fix family law and child support and never did anything of the kind.
They stabbed us in the back, basically.
We'll also be talking with Tom Mock on the so-called Child Support Agency's research, which it peddles to politicians to justify its own existence. This week we've had more stories about the agency hunting down supposedly rich dads, in the fevered imaginations of some of our more radical feminists, you know, the male bashing kind. They think that all dads are somehow rich and that, you know, they should be hunted down and made to pay. There's nothing more abusive, in fact, than a woman who denies their children a relationship with their fathers, and that the government and their agencies should be acting in this manner as an absolutely putrid abuse of bureaucratic power
Common
and of our
garden
money.
Sexism is what it is.
Ah, shocking. The government promised to fix the fiasco that is the Child Support Agency, and it's done nothing of the kind. We'll touch on that a bit more later.
The question, of course, is what is the Labor Party going to do if they get into power, which
Well, that's why the we'll have later in the show a Labor politician on to, but I don't know whether she'll touch on a lot of those issues. We'll see. We've also got an interview from the US with the head of the world's only commission for men. It's in New Hampshire in the US. And here in Australia, we pay taxes to support so-called sex discrimination commissioners who do nothing but parade their aggressive and often torrid hatred of men and collect a massive salary for perpetrating this style of sexism. In a busy morning, we'll also be hearing from Tony Miller, founder of Dads in Distress. This is a self-help group which saves hundreds of lives and deals with suicidal fathers after they've had their children arbitrarily ripped off them by the so-called judges in the so-called family court. We'll be ending the show talking to Julie Owen. She's the Labor MP from Parramatta. Should be a great interview. Julie took over from Ross Cameron, the Liberal, who couldn't keep it in his pants even though his wife was pregnant, and was on this show some time back when he was briefly responsible for the Child Support Agency. He was yet another Liberal Party politician who couldn't tell us how many Child Support Agency clients die each day, estimated by us and a number of other people to be at least 12 a day. These are mostly fathers, and not all fathers, but the point is that many of these fathers are left impoverished and in poor health and are then attacked by the fuggery of the these bureaucratic agencies, and what a mess they make of people's lives.
Well, they're just not. It's just not the three or four that commit suicide every day. It's all the other health issues associated with it as well, isn't it?
What separated dad has the money to go to a doctor?
And here we have in today's paper, in today's Telegraph, shot ends standoff. A man shot himself dead last night, ending a four-hour standoff with police. The man, aged in his 20s, died at Nepean Hospital after being treated by ambulance officials. Police were called to the home about 3 p.m. after reports of a man threatening self-harm. Police negotiated with him for several hours. A woman and her three children were inside the home during the siege, were uninjured. So it's happening all around us.
Yes, it's amazing the level of stress that these people are put under. Both men and women, for instance, kill their kids in custody disputes, and until you get there, until you experience your children being arbitrarily removed from you, from your their loving parent, you withhold judgment.
You've got no idea what it's like to go through it until you have, basically.
And this often happens on an allegation. That's all it needs.
Yep.
A good argument, and somebody pointing the finger, and you've lost your kids for life.
Oh, yes, and of course that heightened atmosphere of false allegations has been further exaggerated by the extremely dishonest advertising campaign. Australia says no to violence against women. What's that mean? Australia says yes to violence against men. Why can't Australia just say no to interpersonal violence instead of making and turning it into a gender war and vilifying one sex over the other?
More common garden sexism.
Yes, well, Cameron, of course, Ross Cameron, as we mentioned, was one of the endless politicians who smugly told us that farmers' groups shouldn't expect much funding because they should learn to rely, to stand on their own two feet.
Oh, great advice. Thanks, mate.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the same government has dished out hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars to women's groups and feminist causes, making you proud to pay taxes. Think of all the poor bastards out there in the factories working hard.
Yeah. Again, we should ask, is it all going to change with the change of government?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it seems unlikely.
Julie Owens, who is the Labor MP, as she said, she's a terrific person and terrific talent, and whatever you may think about some of the Labor Party's policies in regard to separated fathers, Julie herself is a terrific person. She's been door-knocking thousands and thousands of people in the Parramatta electorate. She knows more than any other person in the country why the so-called Howard Battlers have deserted the Conservative government in their thousands. Just like separated dads, many of the so-called Howard Battlers found themselves voting Conservative for the first time in their lives, and with dads, it was because they were naive enough to believe the Howard government's rhetoric that he would fix family law and child support. They thought he'd get their children back, and of course your children are a vote-changing issue. With the Battlers, it was because for the first time in their lives they were sitting on a huge little empire with massive mortgages, and they believed the rhetoric that if they only worked hard enough, they too could prosper. That this was the aspirational vote that went to Howard for the first time, and he won him a swagger seat in the western suburbs. Those same people are now drowning in debt and living on credit. Julie has door-knocked literally thousands of them, and that should be a fascinating interview. But first up, we'll take some look at the news around this week. Most striking has been the resignation of Victorian Premier Steve Brax, who supposedly has done so to spend time with his family. Mate, we'd all like to throw in our jobs and spend time with the kids.
Absolutely.
But most of us don't have the massive parliamentary pensions which allow us to do so.
Yes, the Daily Telegraph on Saturday, Simon Benson wrote, the debate over work-life balance, the pressures of public life, ignited yesterday as two of the nation's most senior politicians threw away their careers for the sake of their families. 3 weeks after publicly questioning whether he had failed as a father over his son's drunken car crash, Victorian Premier Steve Brax quit politics yesterday and was followed a few hours later by Deputy Premier John Thwaites. So there you go. And another one, it goes on to say Premier Morris Yemmer, Premier of New South Wales, whose two holidays since the March election have prompted speculation, he is torn between work and family, resolutely refused to comment on the events in Victoria. Well, good on you, Morris Yemmer, for saying nothing.
Yes, another comment made in the Telegraph in the same paper by Michelle Casolino. She writes, on the face of it, Steve Brax's decision to put his family before his political career was a timely and highly personal one. Yesterday, politicians from both sides of the parliamentary divide were lining up to praise the outgoing Victorian Premier's actions, with his colleagues variously describing his decisions as fantastic and terrific. That may well be the case, but as Mr. Brax eases his foot off the political pedal and prepares to spend more time with the family, spare a thought for all the other working parents out there who also know the difficulty of traversing the work-life tightrope. Like John said, it's all very well. They have a nice big fat pension there waiting for them. And not only that, recent statistics have shown us that or recent study that came out of the UK, I think, that where fathers started to stay at home, it didn't guarantee them any more or any custodial rights once the separation of the parents occurred, because the mother still was favoured
by the family courts. Yeah, above the father.
So we're going to a quick break. We'll be back with a senior researcher at the Centre for Independent Studies, Peter Saunders. Back in a moment. We've got Peter Saunders. He's a senior researcher at the Centre for Independent Studies. He's the author of Australia's Welfare Habit, How to Kick It, and his most recent work, The Government Giveth and the Government Taketh Away. Thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. Now, look, you say that the number of people now working, and for people who don't know the debate, maybe you could just run through it. I gather in the 60s, for instance, there was something like 22 people for every person on the dole, and now there's only four or five. What are the exact figures?
Yeah, that's right. No, that's exactly right. Back in 1965, there were it's about 3% of the working age population were living on benefits, full-time reliance on government payments. Now it's about 16 or 17%, so it's gone up at least fivefold taking account of the increase in size of population. And if you work that out as how many people there are working in order to support how many people there are on benefits, then, yeah, it was around about 20 workers for every one person on benefits back in the 60s, and it's about 5 for every one person on benefits today. So
that's astonishing.
That's a major explanation for why your taxes are so high.
And the welfare budget's ballooned out to something like $270 billion a year, is that correct?
The total amount of tax collected by the federal and state governments is around $270 billion, and about 70% of that, so 70 cents in every dollar, goes on social expenditure. Now, let's be clear what I'm talking about there. We're talking about not just income support payments. Income support payments are about $80 or $90 billion. The actual cash transfers that are going on. That's the age pension, which is about $30 billion. Family payments, including payments to single parents and so on, is about $25 billion. Disability pensions, which are just huge. I mean, that's one of the areas that's really blown out over the last 20 years. That's about $12 billion now. Unemployment payments, about $5 billion. So that lot all adds up to about $80 or $90 billion. And then you've got the spending on government services that some or all of us use, Medicare, education be the two big ones, but also sort of nursing homes and this sort of thing. That lot comes to another 130. So you're looking at about $210-$220 billion out of the $270-$280 billion that the government's collecting in tax is going on those social spending.
Of course, a lot of people thought that Howard stood for small government.
Yeah, it's a joke, isn't it?
It's a joke of the first order.
I have a colleague here at the centre, Andrew Norton, who wrote something on this recently in our quarterly magazine. He described the Howard government as big government conservatives, and I think that's absolutely right. The Americans have said the same thing about the Bush administration in America. It's a right-of-center government, clearly, in terms of where its sympathies are, but it spends a huge amount of money. The kind of spending that used to be associated with socialist governments is now seems to be associated with some of these conservative ones.
Peter, could I ask, one thing you say is that the Australians are now more prosperous than ever before, so yeah, the number of people needing government assistance should be falling. Could it be that the wealth is not evenly spread, perhaps?
Well, this, in a sense, is the starting point of this latest book that you mentioned in the introduction, because it's been puzzling me for some time why. I mean, you look at all the figures on the growth of the economy, on the growth of people's spending power, on how many minutes you have to work in order to buy a loaf of bread or whatever. And there's no doubt on all those sort of measures that although there's still people at the bottom of the income distribution who are doing it tough, that there's large numbers of people who, if you just look at the figures, ought to be able to look after themselves now in a way that maybe two, three generations back you wouldn't have expected them to be able to. That we shouldn't need a situation where, I mean, for example, if you look at families, 9 out of 10 families in this country now are getting government payments. Now, it shouldn't be necessary. We shouldn't need to make 90% of families dependent on government.
And that's a real spread of welfare into the middle classes,
yeah, it is.
This Howard government,
right,
isn't it?
That's right. It's one of the things that's often been thrown at the Howard government, and I think justly so, that they've increased the size of middle class welfare, not just through family payments, other kinds of payments. Childcare is the latest one that where there's a big push to get more spending on childcare, a lot of which will go to people who shouldn't need it. The problem is, though, that in a sense, increasing the middle classes do need this kind of support because they're paying so much tax. So what I'm looking
True,
at,
isn't it?
You know, what I'm looking at is how much income have you got coming in before the government messes around with you? And the answer is enough, for a lot of us, enough to pay our own way. But then the government takes all this tax away from households, and the household turns around and says, well, hang on, we haven't got enough to live on now, so the government gives it back to them. And this is why I called this latest book, The Government Giveth and the Government Taketh Away. John, can I just give you, figures that actually came out after my book went to press, which make the case even stronger than the book does. From the Australian Bureau of Statistics last month, June 2007, the ABS released a report which calculated how much tax different kind of households were paying and the value of all the government benefits that they were getting back. And in particular, if you look at families with children, couples with children.
Mm.
It works out that coupled households with dependent children are paying, on average, $519 a week in taxes. That's income tax and GST and other forms of tax and so on.
So that's an average family with two children.
Yeah, the average family with children, with dependent children, a couple.
$519
a week going out of that household in tax.
Yeah.
And $501 a week coming into that household in either income transfers or other kind of government services like Medicare and
family payments.
It's complete madness. This is completely mad.
It's hardly worth going to work, isn't it?
Well, it's you have to ask what's the point of the government of one set of government bureaucrats, at the Australian Tax Office, taking $519 away from you each week, and another set at Centrelink or wherever, Medicare, putting it back in the other pocket. We're no better off. The average family is actually no different by the time government's finished with it than it was before, except the difference is that now, because they're $500 down every week, they have to put their hand out to the government for $500 worth of income support or services, whereas they could have provided those things for themselves. They could have made their own choices about how they were going to spend their own money and gone and spent it.
And, of course, they're tied up then with government bureaucracy. So, one, the government knows every detail about their personal life, and two, they're dealing with these nightmare bureaucracies. Anyone who ever deals with Centrelink and all the other bureaucracies know that they're an absolute nightmare to deal with.
That's they're expensive as well. They skim a whole lot off the top just for administration fees.
Well, that's right. It's inefficient because you say there are the costs. Mm. But I mean, in a sense, there's economic. I go through this in the book. I mean, why are we worried about this? Well, for economic reasons and, if you like, for sociological reasons. I mean, I'm a sociologist. I'm not an economist by training. Mm. The economic reasons are obvious. They are the issues about, well, this is inefficient. This is costing so much money. This is also, just by levying so much tax on people, we know the effect that's having on work incentives and so on. All of this is madness economically. But then you turn to the social consequences of all this, and I think they're even worse. Because sociologically, what we're doing is completely destroying the spirit of self-reliance in this country. Every now and again, budget time last year, for example, federal budget last year, I went on an ABC phone-in program the day after the budget. I mean, there was me and other people who were supposed to know what we're talking about.
Yes.
And we were fielding these questions coming in from people. And I was expecting to be fielding questions about, well, you know, is this a good move or a bad move? And why did they do this? And what's going to be the impact of this on unemployment or whatever? But those weren't the questions at all. The questions were all about, I'm not getting enough.
Why aren't I getting
as much as the person down the road who's in a similar situation, but they get more than me because they've got, you know, a kid of this age and I've got a kid of that. Now, that kind of mentality is understandable. I mean, you can't really blame people for reacting like that. But that's how we've all been trained to view the government now, that the government is some kind of...
Infinite bank.
It's a poker machine.
Yeah. It's a provider.
You sort of pull the lever and you expect a load of money to come crashing out. And if the bloke next door is getting more than you are, then you start complaining. It's unedifying. It's completely destroying the sense that we can run our own lives without needing politicians to stick their noses in every nook and cranny of our lives.
Peter, could I just take you back to that $500 taxes figure that you quoted? Like 40 years ago, we wouldn't have even been earning that. So isn't that relevant to your earnings? I mean, it seems certainly a large figure, $500, but the average earnings now is well over $1,000
a week. Yeah, I've got figures. I've got it all broken down actually in front of me. It's, unfortunately, these figures now, these are my figures rather than the ABS's. These figures are a bit out of date now. It's going back to 2002, so we're going back 5 years. But, I mean, to give you an example, if you take these are averages again. Take a couple with children of school age 5 years ago. Their average income, before the government got hold of them, their average income was $1,160 a week. So what's that? That's about getting on for $60,000 a year, $55,000-$60,000 a year, and they were paying out at that time $400 of taxes, and they were getting in $500 of benefits. So they were ending up $100 a week better off as a result of paying huge amounts of tax and getting huge amounts of benefits. The government was making a marginal difference. So instead of having $1,160 a week, they ended up with $1,270 a week after all that. Now, I mean, my view is, can't we find a more sensible way? You know, if we need to top them up by $100 a week, then let's do it. without taking the 400 or 500 of tax in order to give them 500 or 600 of benefits. I mean, it's just that that is what we've got to try and find sensible ways of avoiding, I think.
We're talking with Peter Saunders. He's the senior researcher at the Centre for Independent Studies here in Sydney. He's the author of Australia's Welfare Habit, How to Kick It, and his latest tome, The Government Giveth and the Government Taketh Away. We'll be back in one moment.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. That your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
And we're back talking with Peter Saunders. He's the senior researcher at the Centre for Independent Studies and the author of two books on Australia's welfare habit, Australia's Welfare Habit, How to Kick It, and the latest, The Government Giveth and the Government Taketh Away. Welcome back to the show.
Yes, thanks, John.
Now, we see some absolutely frenetic policies being announced by the Howard government, particularly as it falls in the polls and in the lead-up to the election. One of the latest I noticed was something costing $960 million where a co-payment to your super payments if you earn under $54,000 a year or something has been doubled this year for no particular reason that I can think of. Why should people go out to work in factories to give hundreds of millions of dollars to super funds, for goodness sake?
Yeah, but very often we're ending up giving it to each other. I mean, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul all the time. The every single budget, and it's going to get worse, it's an election year, it's going to get worse, but every budget, every federal budget, you'll find Peter Costello stands up, and in addition to making all the statements about the, you know, the tax rates or whatever, he'll suddenly say, oh, and I'm giving so much this year to the old folks, or I'm giving so much to... parents, or I'm giving so much in this case, you know, to lower income people for their super and so on. And these aren't policies that have been thought through and reasoned out and have got a long term bearing in terms of what they're intending to do. These are just dollops of money which you and I have paid, which are now going to be dolloped into somebody else's lap. And next year they'll pay, and we'll have it dolloped into our lap. And it's just, it's the unfortunate dynamics of a democratic system, in a sense. But it's vote buying.
Yeah, they're just and buying.
Well, he's only dishing out that money because he wants you to vote for him.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I'm afraid that assuming there's an election coming up in November, and it's not just the coalition, we'll see it from Labour too, that we're going to see a whole load of promises yet again. The last election 3 years ago cost us, I think it was $60 billion over 3 years. There were press conferences being called where Howard was spending $1 million a minute, and we're going to see it again.
And we fall for it over and over.
We fall for it, and you know, you have to ask: is there no constituency out there for a politician to stand up and say, actually, instead of taking more money away from you in order to give it back again, I'm just going to stop taking money away from you?
We'd all be better off if they just went away, wouldn't we?
Yeah, we'd all be a lot better off because, you'd avoid all these inefficiencies. And
there's a website which accuses John Howard of being a Fabian socialist seriously claims that he's a Fabian. But sometimes you really start to wonder, maybe they got it right.
Yeah, well, I mean, the trouble is that the economy, obviously, has been so strong for the last 16, 17 years that it generates additional revenues for government every year. We've reached a point, I mean, one of the points I talk about in this new book is the Future Fund. I mean, that we've reached a point where the government has paid off all the debt, or as much debt as it dares to pay off, and it's still got all these surpluses coming in. It doesn't really know what to do with it. Now, in that situation, one thing a government's going to do is start throwing the money around in order to make itself popular, and, it takes a lot of self-discipline not to do that. But I think somehow somebody's got to stand up and say, look, this is madness. And it's producing a whole load of expectations in the population that when the economy does hit the buffers, as will happen at some point, there'll be a downturn. Those expectations are going to go unmet, and there's going to be, all hell to pay.
It destroys the national psyche, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. One of the things I found, I mean, as you can tell from my accent, I was born in Britain. One of the things I found attractive about coming to Australia was I had a notion that Australia was a nice blend of Britain and America, in a sense, that it had the American sort of get up and go stuff, but it also had the sort of British, more compassionate end as well. And I think that is true. I think Australia does have that blend, but the get up and go initiative, take responsibility for yourself, make things happen, give it a go, I think is getting smothered. Well, by this big government.
We're so over-regulated. I mean, we've got state governments, with an upper house and a lower house and a governor, and then on top of all that, we've got the federal government, which duplicates the whole thing, and it works out, we've practically got, one politician for every 20 or 30 people or something. I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
Yes, it is, and those politicians, A, are going to want to make a difference by spending money, and B, having got to the positions they're in, are going to want to tell us all what to do, because that's why you become a politician.
But it also seems like they're in the pocket of big business as well, because with the climate control thing, I mean, they're more interested in pushing coal or big industry, the big end of town's agenda, than they are of looking after the welfare of the poor people out there who have to put up with flooding, hurricanes and the various other climate nasties that are starting to be unleashed.
I think politicians will be in the pocket of whoever is in a position to deliver votes and power next time around, and they'll pay off whoever needs paying off. Sometimes that will be the big end of town. Other times it will be cobbling together coalitions of other groups. But it's all fairly unprincipled stuff, I think.
Talking of Britain, I've just read that book, What's Left, by Nick Cohen, a journalist over there.
Yeah, I read about it. I haven't read it.
Oh, it's a fantastic book. Yeah. And he says, we've had this long tradition of liberal policies and, social justice and so on. He says, and now look at us, quote, the work ethic is gone, family values have gone, courtesy is gone, and common decency is gone.
This is it. There's some interesting literature coming out of Britain. I think Britain is further down this track than Australia is, and which is why it's worth trying to sound the alarm bells now in Australia, because you can point to Britain and say, look, that's where we're headed. There's some important stuff coming out of Britain. The Labour MP Frank Field, that we brought over a couple of times, is very strong on all this, about the way in which the welfare state, unintentionally, set up with the best of intentions, to produce a caring, compassionate society that would be cohesive, where everybody would care for each other and so on. What it's actually produced is this society of sort of hedonistic individualists who don't give a damn about other people, where crime rates are going through the roof, and that's happened in Australia too.
There is no sort of sense of social cohesion or personal responsibility.
No, because those things have to be built from the bottom. Government can't parachute in a sense of responsibility and cohesion from above. It's got to be built from below. And if government keeps doing things for us, there's nothing left for us to do for ourselves or to help our neighbours with. And of course, there's not going to be any social cohesion.
And perhaps one of the very extreme examples of that is what is happening in the isolated indigenous communities.
Yep.
The sit-down money has completely destroyed the civic culture of a once noble people.
Absolutely right. And to give the Howard government some credit, because we've been bashing it here for the last 25 minutes, I do think that the initiative taken over the last few weeks by Mal Brough is to be commended. I mean, there may be problems in the detail, I think there are, but at least there's the sense of recognising what's been causing the problem and trying to do something about it.
Sure, but why wait till an election year? I mean, you've got to be a little bit cynical about it.
Yep. Yes, although there is also, I mean, as you know, Noel Pearson has been pushing a very strong sort of welfare reform agenda for the indigenous communities for some time, and his Cape York Institute came out with a report, you know, that they've been doing a lot of the groundwork, and I think the government came in over the top of that as much as for an election.
And, of course, you only have to look at some of the housing estates here in the western suburbs to realise that there's a serious level of decay, not only in the indigenous communities, but in the Anglo communities.
Yeah.
Look, we're running out of time. What's the solution?
What a gloomy interview. I think there are some. There's no easy solutions. I mean, in this latest book, I suggest in terms of trying to get rid of middle class welfare, which I think is important, that we try and push that back, so that at least the middle Australia can start taking more responsibility for itself. I mean, I've come out with various sets of proposals, including sort of voluntary opt-outs from government provision for those that think they can do better for themselves. I mean, if I feel that I don't particularly want a government age pension when I retire, I'd rather save for myself, then it seems to me that I should be able to tell the government that, renounce my right to a government age pension, and have the government tax me less, so that I can put more money away in my own retirement savings. I think the same for health. I think that if I'm willing to take responsibility for my own and my family's health care needs for the rest of my life, then I should be able to say, look, okay, Medicare's a fine system for those that want it. I don't want it. I'm now reduce my taxes so that the money that I'm currently paying into Medicare, I'll pay in to my own health system instead. Now, these sort of things, you know, the details need to be worked out, but the basic principle is, go back to this churning, this $500 going out and $500 coming back, that we've got to, the way to reduce that is to enable people that are willing to take the responsibility to say, take less away from me, and I, in turn, will demand less of you.
Individual autonomy, I think that's what you...
Yeah, self-reliance.
Yep.
We've been talking with Peter Saunders. He's the author of Australia's Welfare Habit, How to Kick It, and a new book, The Government Giveth and the Government Taketh Away. He's a senior researcher at the Centre for Independent Studies. You can look up their website.
www.cis.org.au.
And there's some fascinating material on that. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for asking me, John.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, my daddy went away and fought in World War II, in the jungles of New Guinea, tried to see it through. Ended up with malaria and TB too, got a little weaker each day. All the medals wouldn't pay for his lungs to be new, so they shipped him to a hospital to pull him through. The smoking didn't help, but he never knew the price that he'd have to pay. With his three little girls and his wife at his side, he worked with his hands and he beamed with pride. But when his oldest daughter got sick and died, he couldn't understand life that way. Then a son was born, and when I finally came, he was proud for me to carry on the family name. Then he built us a home down on Botany Bay, with his brothers and his friends after work each day. Cutting timber on the weekend till his lungs would ache, worked a little harder each day. A little brother made it even, two girls and two boys. In this loving home, there was plenty of noise. Daddy spent some time at the club with the boys, while we grew more each day. Start a life of their own. My brother and me, we were still at home. Daddy was proud when the grandkids came, even though they couldn't carry on the family name. So I went off and found a girl of my own, moved away up north to start our own loving home. We had two girls and a boy of our own, being a family from that day. The kids are growing, got a life of their own. They'll go off and start their own loving home. My son's now a man and I'm here to say I'll be proud for him to carry on the family.
Recently attended the American Boys and the Boy Crisis Conference, held on July 13th and 14th in Washington, D.C. I recorded a number of presentations and interviews at the conference, which will be broadcast on Dads on the Air over the coming weeks. My first interview was with Scott Garman from the New Hampshire Commission on the Status of Men. In May 2002, New Hampshire Governor Jean Shaheen signed into law HB 587 FNA to establish a Commission on the Status of Men. This commission was, and still is, as far as I can determine, the first and only commission for men anywhere on the planet. This, of course, contrasts with the fact that for the past 40 years, almost every state and federal legislature in the world has had commissions acting on behalf of women. I started off by asking Scott to tell us a bit about the history of the commission.
As far as I know, New Hampshire is the first state that now has a commission on the status of men, and it's considered part of the executive branch in the state. And there was a fairly long struggle to create the commission. Back in the late 90s, there was an effort to introduce bills that would create a commission on the status of men, which were modeled after the New Hampshire Commission on the Status of Women.
Which has been around for...
Which has existed since the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. So these bills came in, and the first attempt in the late 90s almost succeeded. What happened was the bill was amended to create a legislative committee to study the status of men. So this consisted of a number of people who were appointed, and they went and did a short report, which talked about issues such as male suicides, men's health problems, prostate cancer, the problems of fatherlessness, and the issues of the boys and young men are facing in education, particularly being behind girls in areas of reading and literacy. And with that report that was officially commissioned by the legislature, we were then able to go back to the legislature and say, look, here's the report that you commissioned us to write. It has all these, you know, reasons. And I believe the legislature was moved in large part by the suicide and men's health issues, and finally agreed to create a commission on the status of men, which has existed technically since, I believe, 2003 or so. I've served on the commission for a couple of years now, and we're mandated to study three main areas: men's health issues, the problems that boys are facing in education, and the social impact of fatherlessness on society.
You don't have a brief to look at the issues that separated men often face, only tangentially through the fatherlessness issue?
I consider that part of, you know, exactly the issues of fatherlessness in society. Obviously, during a breakup of a family, most of the time, if there is a primary custody situation, it is usually, you know, mothers who receive custody, and fathers are then distanced from their families in a way. So I think that, that the issues of divorce and stuff definitely fall within the commission's mandate.
Right, and I guess also through the issue of suicide, which is, you know, has, you know, 10 times higher amongst divorced and separated men. So I guess through that men's health stream, you're also looking at issues of separated dads. So, yeah.
Definitely.
In the first place, were you funded to produce that report before it was a commission, and then when the commission started, was it a funded commission?
No, at no time has the commission ever received any state funding. In fact, when the first report was written, I'm not even sure off the top of my head how the funding was received in order to print copies of the report. That was done somehow. The Commission on the Status of Men has always existed through private funds. We've received maybe a couple of $1,000s here and there, which has been used to print. We are mandated to create a biennial report. That's a report every 2 years about our activities. We've come out with one report. We hope to have another one out this fall. And we can technically apply for grants. We don't really have any grant writers in the group since we're kind of an all-volunteer operation. We're really limited in scope in what we do.
And so recently the commission came up for renewal, is that right?
Yes, yeah. The first time the commission was actually created, the bill had a built-in sunset to it to have the commission expire in September of this year, 2007. And so in the spring legislative session, we had another bill introduced that repeals the sunset portion of the commission's original legislation, and at the same time also tried to add an appropriation of approximately $60,000 per year so the commission could hire an executive director. Now, I don't want to ever make the Commission on the Status of Men and the Commission on the Status of Women seem like they're in opposition to each other, or this is a zero-sum game. But the New Hampshire Commission on the Status of Women receives a budget somewhere around, I believe, $180,000 every 2 years. So we were not even asking anywhere close to what the Commission on the Status of Women was making. We recognized that we wanted to get started, get an executive director, and kind of move on from there. But the legislature did not feel that was an important enough issue for them to fund.
So you're going to obviously continue regardless, and you're looking for more sources of private funding at the moment?
Well, funding, yes, definitely. If we had funding, we could commission research, but I think there's a significant amount of data out there we can collect and put into reports. And because we're an official state commission, that has a certain amount of weight when we present that to legislators and policymakers and so on throughout the state.
Have there been certain members of parliament who've had to be in there pushing for this in terms of introducing your stuff through the New Hampshire legislature, or is it something that you do yourselves? Or?
Well, we're officially not a policy-making body, so we cannot create laws. Obviously, we can come up with proposals or recommendations if there was a law. For example, there was a bill in New Hampshire this past term which would require New Hampshire health insurance companies to pay for prostate cancer screening exams. Now, for breast cancer screening exams, insurance companies have been mandated to pay for that for some time, but this has never been the case for prostate cancer exams. But there was a bill in the legislature to do this, and the Commission on the Status of Men passed a resolution during one of our meetings that we support this bill, and we believe that it's important, obviously, to fund the screening of prostate cancer.
And you think that holds some weight?
And that holds some influence, definitely.
Yeah.
You know,
so. Yeah. And the one report you have brought out...
Yep, which you can download from our website, which is at www.nh.gov/CSM for Commission on the Status of Men.
Now, that report, was that a collection of existing data which you collated to give an overview of the existing picture rather than commissioning any new research yourself?
Right? Exactly. That's all we could do. So we went to the New Hampshire Department of Education. We actually did do some original research in the sense that we have a medical doctor who is the chair of the group. He worked with the state medical examiner's office, the coroner's office, which looks at all suicides that happen in the state. And we looked at the data they were collecting on each suicide, and we worked with their office to try to collect more data on suicides. For example, things like what was the marital status of these men, you know, on a period of time before the suicide happened, to try to track other factors that might be ignored currently because we're not collecting the data on it. But basically...
So, did you go back to existing records existing cases and try and find that data, or have you put mechanisms in place so that that data is now being recorded for new suicides?
For new suicides, yes, right. That's correct. The data is now being recorded for that.
So. Right, so it'll obviously take some time for that data to come through. And,
correct.
But at least we'll be able to get a more meaningful picture of around men and suicide.
Yes, and one of the problems, too, is that we actually now have a certain amount of data that we could take a look at, but we do not have a statistician to interpret some of that data. So one of the first things I think we would have done if we had received state funding this time around was find a statistician to do a report on that. But we're going to continue to wait. We're going to still look into some more creative options, working with the University of New Hampshire, maybe trying to find some graduate students who might want to do a research project on this. Mm. But that takes time and takes energy, and that's still something down the road.
Great. Well, Scott, it's a pleasure to meet you, and thanks for taking the time to tell us about the commission. And all the best for your work in the future, and let's hope you get some good funding opportunities down the track.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You can find out more about the New Hampshire Commission on the Status of Men at nh.gov/CSM. The Boys and the Boy Crisis Conference website can be found at trueequality.com. This is Greg Andreessen reporting from Washington, D.C. for Dads on the Air.
Ignorance, 100% for arrogance. One call from a lawyer gives a dodgy report. So selling their soul for affluence, writing reports that are dubious, which makes their victims furious. They write these reports that are thrown out of court. Their lack of ethics is curious. So beware of shunky psychologists, this self-centered group of narcissists. Their own code of ethics ignored and made useless, failed to contribute to make our child fatherless, and so we became their antagonist. The lawyer, mother, and psychologist, this troika of psychotic anarchists, conspiring to steal our children we love. It's no wonder that we become activists. There's some that they claim to be expert, but for cash they will gladly subvert the innocent child that they're there to protect. This must be exposed to avert. So beware of shunky psychologists, this self-centered group of narcissists. Their own code of ethics ignored and made useless, which helped to contribute to make our child fatherless, and so we became their antagonists. They're hungry for prestige and money, but they're totally lacking in empathy. No conscience they have, and so they're bereft of good judgment as well as credibility. If you question their own code of conduct, the board does their best to obstruct all attempts to obtain the justice deserved for our children who'll see them corrupt. So beware of shunky psychologists, this self-centered group of narcissists. Their own code of ethics ignored and made useless, which helped to contribute to make our child fatherless, and so we became their antagonists. So beware of shunky psychologists, this self-centered group of narcissists. Their own code of ethics ignored and made useless, which helped to contribute to make our child fatherless, and so we became their antagonists. And it's so we became their antagonists. We're back with Dads on the Air.
And on the line we've got Tom Mock, who's looking at a lot of the research around and has been regularly persisting with that Dad's on the Air should have more of a look at a lot of the research going around. Are you there, Tom?
Yeah, hi, John.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you've been looking at the Child Support Agency, I understand.
I have, in response to a public available document called What If I'm Not Happy with Child Support Agency Service?
Not many people are happy, but off you go.
Well, they're trying to make out that people are happy, and the way they justify that claim is in this document, there's a little box, highlighted box, and I'll just quickly read, the number of complaints received and upheld under independent review continues to decline. Total complaints received in 05-06 were 10,403, compared with 12,258 in 04-05, a decrease of nearly 18%.
Yes.
And what's interesting about this data, for a start, is that the decrease is actually 15%.
All right. for a start, they can't add up.
Well,
what is an independent review, anyway?
Pardon?
What do they mean by an independent review?
My discussions with the Child Support Agency, they've indicated to me two possibilities. They don't seem to know themselves. First, I was told that independent review is through the Ombudsman.
Right. You've only got to read some of those studies.
And then the person I spoke to did a double take and said, oh, no, actually, the independent review is a review by someone within the Child Support Agency who didn't receive the complaint in the first place.
And that's an independent review?
That's how they've defined an independent review.
It's an internal roundabout, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, well, the Bolsheviks created the first Child Support Agencies and their legacy is here with us today.
And there's another issue in this statement is that they've compared the number of complaints received and upheld with total complaints.
Right.
Which is like comparing apples and oranges, and it really doesn't give any indication on the Child Support Agency service at all. With regards to the 18%, the way they've arrived, it should actually be 15%, but the way they've arrived at the 18% is based on the actual decrease in total complaints and then taken as a percentage of the lowest number, which was for 05-06, which is a stock standard tactic of unscrupulous stockbrokers.
It's just dishonesty, isn't it? Dishonesty.
Well, the agency have assured me that it was an honest mistake.
But honest dishonesty.
It goes even further. That this document, the numbers that I've just read, has come from the agency's last general report. And I was assured that the mistake had been picked up just after the report had been published. Yet this public document, What If I'm Not Happy with CSA Service, was published way after they'd picked up the original mistake. So it seems like the Child Support Agency External Affairs Department is not collaborating with the department responsible for writing their annual report.
Be right. So, yes, there's a lot of dubious figures bouncing around with the agency. Would it be your impression that there is much happiness with the agency? Are customers satisfied?
As a scientist, I really do want to know, on a broader scale, from anecdotal evidence, from individuals, no, there's not much happiness with the Child Support Agency. And interestingly, at the moment, there's what's called the Family Law Data Mapping Project, which is being developed in response to the House of Reps Standing Committee on Family and Community Affairs, Every Picture Tells a Story report. And the AIFS and the Australian Social Science Data Archive are doing that mapping, and Philip Ruddock himself demanded that happen to monitor exactly what's going on with these new family law changes. However, my argument is that the data that the CSA is collecting needs to be part of the Family Law Data Mapping Project.
Look, Tom, we're out of time now. We've just got a very busy schedule this morning. We'll have you on again next week. I think you're going to look at some of the obesity studies next week, aren't you?
Yeah, look, there's some recent Australian research published from the Children's Hospital down in Melbourne, how paternal behaviour is a significant influencing factor in reducing obesity amongst children.
All right, we'll have you on next week. Well, hopefully we'll have a bit more time next week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom Mox.
He's been looking at a lot of the research that's going on around Australia and has been persistently suggesting that Dads on the Air should take more note of the academic research that's available. So he's making sure we do.
We'll be back in a moment.
We'll be talking with Julie Owens. She's the MP for Parramatta, and she'll be talking about why Howard's battlers have turned. We've got Julie Owen. She's the MP for Parramatta. Are you there, Julie?
I am. I'm here.
Thanks so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. That's great. Now, you're most famous for door-knocking thousands upon thousands of Howard's battlers.
Yes, apparently so. Yeah, I with a group of about four. I have to say it wasn't me alone. A group of about four people. I've door-knocked probably about 35,000 houses now in the last 3 years or so.
Goodness gracious. Mm. And these are a lot of people that were lost to Labor, weren't they? They went Conservative probably for the first time in their lives, partly because they were sitting on on large mortgages, and they were aspirational, and they thought to succeed you had to vote Conservative. Is that fair enough?
That might be it. I mean, in some areas that I represent, there have been swings of up to 10% towards the Howard government over the last sort of 10 years. Probably for a range of reasons. I really don't think there's... I'm not one of those people that ascribe to the idea that there's one reason, because I'm in a marginal seat and my seat is so diverse that I see when I'm door-knocking that there are many, many reasons. But I think partly you're right. There's a time of life, I think, in people's lives when they're at the early stages of building a life, sometimes alone, sometimes with others, and sometimes with children, and they get their first mortgage. They might have... You know, they might be going to university for the first time. They're basically, the way I put it is that they're out there on their own. You know, they don't have family wealth. They're actually doing something for the first time. And so they're very much focused on their own needs, as they should be at that time of life. And because of that, and because that they've exposed themselves by taking these risks, they're a bit more vulnerable than most, you know. So they tend to respond more to what's happening in government circles than people who have a larger buffer zone.
And you found that far from being rewarded for voting Conservative, they're now drowning in debt and living on credit, that they're really being pushed to the wall. Is that your experience?
Well, that's right. There are a lot of families out there at the moment under incredible pressure. And you really only get that when you... You really only find out about that when you go out and meet them. You know, they're not... things haven't got so bad that they'll come to my office, but they're just out there every day struggling. And you're right, the debt levels are very high across our community, and that's not just mortgage stress, although that's very real. Large numbers are now paying more than 30% of their income in mortgage payments. It's also rental stress. In my electorate, 33% of tenants, that's a third of renters in Parramatta, are already paying more than 30% of their household income on rent, which means they're locked into renting. You know, that's pretty much the end of owning for them. But there's also rising petrol prices, rising childcare costs.
Oh, I think petrol has really seriously impacted on people in a way that the government basically pretends hasn't happened.
Well, I think that's the alarming thing, and I think that's the underlying reason why people are turning away from John Howard, is that he's been there for 11 years. And he's so lost touch, he just hasn't noticed. You know, up until a year ago, and even now, he can still barely restrain himself from saying, you know, working families have never been better off.
We've never been better off. We have a booming economy. Yeah. And people don't feel that, do they?
Well, I think the government and the Treasurer in particular, who spends more time with figures, I think, than with people, look at the economy as a whole, and that includes all of the mega profits of the really big companies and the mining boom and, you know, the commodities generally boom, and China and India sucking our resources, you know, into those economies as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So when you look at the total, there's more money flowing through this economy than we've ever seen. But... when you get down to the people who are the engine room, and that's who, you know, my constituents are, they're the engine room. They're working families that have got regular jobs, that are living regular lives.
Yeah.
You know, they might be subcontractors, they might have little businesses of their own, but they're the engine room. You know, they're the bit that keeps the whole country just ticking over. You know, and they are doing it so tough.
Well, like you said, it's money flowing through the economy. It's not actually stopping in the economy and doing anybody good. I mean, we all get huge incomes, but we've got huge expenses as well.
Well, I felt that way about the last budget. I looked at it. It was a massive amount of money. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, that's going to flow across this economy, you know, at the speed of light, and in 6 months' time, you won't see anything. You won't know where it was. And I think that's the way people are starting to think about John Howard. You know, 11 years of the biggest boom, we're in the biggest global boom, that we've had in 50 years. There's a phenomenal boom in every country at the moment. Everybody's actually doing well. But you look at it and you think, you know, what difference has he made? What has he left behind after 11 years? And people are starting to want that. They're starting to think, okay, well, what about our hospitals? What about our schools? You know, what about our education system? What about our skills?
What about our roads?
What about... Yeah, well, that's right. And you know, some of these things that we're talking about are
state issues.
But, you know, we have a situation at the moment where the federal government has massive amounts of money and the states are really stretched and the infrastructure is in desperate need of renewal. And we're living through the best boom we've ever had.
Julie, what do you say to those that say it's part of the problem is as a result of the good times that we have had for the you know, the economy's been powering along for a few years now, and people have often put themselves in high levels of debt, which is not really the government's fault, is it? It's their personal choices.
The government is never responsible for a person's personal choice. But when you see a trend taking place, and remember, of course, that now it takes seven times the annual income to buy an average house these days. So it's not as if the whole country is looking for mansions. I mean, mm-hmm. even to buy an average house these days is out of the range of a person on an average income.
But isn't that because of supply and demand? Hasn't that come about because...
This is a criticism you hear a lot, actually, that to counter this argument. They say, well, it's all your fault because you went into debt. You should have been more sensible.
Yeah, that is the argument that John Howard makes. John Howard says he can't be responsible for the choices people make. But what we have at the moment in Australia is a trend where it's becoming increasingly impossible for an average family to live what would have been considered an average life.
And people were so encouraged, weren't they, to buy their own house to fulfil their dreams.
Well, they certainly were. And you also have a government which is, transferred a lot of debt onto people as well through HECS debt. So we have people now who can't buy in their 20s because they still have HECS debt. And we also have a government that, in spite of the fact that families were struggling and we had a booming economy, ripped away job security with work choices.
Absolutely.
As well. So you have a government that...
Just on that, sorry, how is work choices playing in the electorate?
It's probably the single biggest issue of concern. I mean, people are genuinely afraid at the moment. And it shows in little ways that yeah. a person will come up to me in a shopping centre now, because I stand around in shopping centres a lot, I do a lot of mobile offices, and tell me about a problem in their workplace. And when I say to them, look, what's your name, I might be able to do something, they won't give it to me.
No.
Because they're so afraid that if their boss found out they were talking to me, their job would be gone tomorrow. That's a new thing.
Mm.
That's new. But I also meet so many people whose job security has gone. They've been moved off, more regular work into casual work. They no longer get to choose which hours they work.
My neighbour was a staunch Howard supporter, a young bloke with two young kids under four, gorgeous little kids they are, and he lost his job because he wouldn't sign an AWA, and he couldn't be more vitriolically anti-Howard now. Not that he's pro-you lot particularly, but he couldn't dislike Howard more right this minute.
Yeah, look, it's a dreadful piece of legislation. It really does rip away rights and conditions that we built up over 100 years.
What it gets me is he had absolutely no mandate for it. He never mentioned it in the lead-up to the election.
Only the unfair dismissal.
Which he very cleverly bundled
into
work choices, so that whenever anyone talks about work choices, he goes off about unfair dismissal.
That's right.
He's going to do that anyway. That also is a particularly harsh piece of legislation. We're well aware on my side of politics, and we have been for quite some time, and we talked about how it should have been amended for many years, and John Howard simply wouldn't move. He wanted to abolish it.
Because there wasn't any doubt, I don't think, that it was being rorted to some degree.
Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely. The go-away money, where people were forcing through the courts employers to really just pay them to get rid of it, to get out of the legal costs, if you like, that really had to be stopped. But on the other hand, you have a situation where a person who's worked for a company for 9 years, 11 months, gets sacked to avoid paying the long service leave. You get situations like that. That's actually not fair. Not right. And in order to stop that sort of thing, in order to stop bad behaviour, you need to have some laws. They need to be moved further towards the middle than they were. There's no doubt they need to be better balanced than they were, to avoid employers being exploited by people who really did actually deserve to be sacked. But you also need laws that protect people who didn't. So somewhere in the middle of none and what we had is the reality. Just as with work choices, you know, it's gone far too far. It's gone far too far.
Yes, it definitely has.
The employer side.
Now, we are a father's program here, obviously. We're dads on the air, and we are interested in finding out what the Labor Party is going to offer for fathers.
I promised Julie we wouldn't raise this. This is not her portfolio. She's the local member for Parramatta, and unless you feel comfortable about that, that's Tanya Plibersek's not job, not Julie's.
Oh, look, I'd be happy to come back and do it another time.
Yeah.
I'm aware because I deal with people every day, both men and women.
That there are two sides to the story.
Well, it's more that it's not that there are just two sides to the story. There are two terrible sides to the story.
Yes.
And in an election year, I honestly don't think this should ever be an election issue. I think it's too personal and it's too hurtful and it's too difficult to be pulled apart in that in the hype and the glare of vote getting.
Julie, do you have a high percentage of single parent households in your electorate?
I do. And in this office, where we deal with people every day, we spend a lot of time helping people through particularly child support problems.
Now, look, I want to get back, sorry, this whole financial situation and the dissonance that's occurring with the Howard government and with the reality on the ground. I went to a function, for example, post-Costello at the Western Hotel in town, beautiful hotel, and the president of the Liberal Party, in the winding up address after Costello had given his post-budget review, said, in a very have and have more moment, that we have all, talking to the big end of town here, we have all prospered over the last 10 years. We have all seen our houses increase massively in value and indeed in number. We have seen our share portfolios increase massively in value. We have all prospered, and that is why we must vote Liberal to preserve this prosperity. That's not what's happening on the streets of Parramatta, is it?
Well, I'll have to go and find my share portfolio.
Same here.
I bought T2, so my share portfolio is looking really healthy.
Yeah, that was a smart idea.
And that's about as far as my share portfolio goes. It's very, very patchy. You know, if you bought your house at the right time and you had more than one, you had an investment property and you did it all before the property boom, you might have done just fine, you know. And people who are at the top end of the income scale do actually seem to be doing quite well. But it is really, really patchy. And for people, you know, I put it this way, you know, when you walk around my electorate, there are some areas that are perceived as being quite well off. But that's all they are. They're reasonably comfortable. And when you go into it, what you find are people who were teachers, or they worked in hospitals. They had those secure jobs. They got married young. They bought a house which was cheap, which appreciated incredibly well. They came in and out of the workforce because they had really secure industrial relations in those kinds of jobs, and they stayed married. Yes. And what you end up with in their 50s and their 60s are people who, through the consistency of their lives, have done really well, have done well enough. You know, they've had good, regular lives. But it's getting harder and harder and harder to see how a person starting their life, their adult life now, will do that. And
many of us don't live consistent lives.
Well,
many of us
swap jobs. And I'm also seeing that the pressures that families are under now is making it harder and harder for their marriages to survive.
Yeah, also, what do you see for your average dad out there and mum? What is happening into those relationships
I'm seeing more and more cases, and I find it really frightening. I'm seeing more and more cases where the husband and the wife actually work alternate hours, because if they both work at the same time, they can't have childcare. They can't afford childcare.
Yeah.
So the woman is working nights and the man is working days, or vice versa, or one of them is working night shift and one of them is working day shift, so that one of them can be home all the time and look after the children, which means that they actually don't get time with each other.
Yeah.
I'm also meeting couples where both of them are on casual hours and neither of them knows when they're working. I'm quite frightened by the number of children I find home alone.
Really?
Just, particularly in school holidays.
Yeah, tell us more about that. I mean, literally, what sort of age are you talking about?
Oh, I'm talking six-year-olds.
Six-year-olds.
Very young.
You knock on the door.
Knock on the door, and a
parents
very young
are at work.
Child. Well, the parents don't come to the door, so I'm assuming they're not there. I'm frightened by the number of those children that actually open the door.
Really? Yeah. I'm anyone
saying,
could be knocking
the
on the door.
Don't open the door. Don't open the door. You know. Now, sometimes the parents are there and they come out later, but I'm particularly in school holidays, I find that quite frightening. And I know because sometimes I've gone back to those houses. That, you know, I find cases where both parents are working casual. They find out that morning whether they're working. Now, you know, flexibility, which the government talks about, is all very fine if that flexibility works both ways. But we know in work choices it doesn't. It's flexibility for the employer. But it's very difficult for families to survive as families and to raise their children well if they can't have enough advance notice to organise childcare to make sure they can take their child to the soccer every week at the same time.
Yep,
and to
time.
Actually spend time together. You know, to actually be able to spend time as a family together. And that's becoming increasingly difficult as well because of the increasing financial pressure on households and the ripping away of those rights at work. You know, the combination of the two together and rising house prices and all the other things, you know, that we've talked about, that is placing incredible pressure on families and making it very difficult for them to do what families need to do in order to grow a good family.
They're and also, of course, as you said to me, drowning in debt and living on credit. Now, just the interest rates on credit cards is causing a major difficulty for a lot of these people, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and credit's becoming more and more easy. Now, again, it's not the government's fault that any single person goes and, you know, takes out a credit card. But when you have national trends like this, when you have, you know, trends that, you know, as a nation our debt is growing, as a nation we're finding it harder and harder to rent, that people who are on the edge of, you know, homelessness, having to stay with friends and, you know, late with their rent and, you know, threat of eviction, when that line is rising up your community, that's an issue of concern. And at the very, very least, it's the government's job to notice.
Because Parramatta is really not a marginal area anymore.
Oh, it is.
Central Sydney, isn't it?
Oh,
it's
marginal,
see what I mean.
Electorally, but it's not marginal in terms of its importance.
Or its demography.
No. In terms of you know its relevance, it's the capital of Western Sydney. It's a city of 2 million people. It's the third largest economy in the country, and it will drive most of the growth because our population will grow faster. If we don't get it right here, you know, the whole country will actually pay that price. This is one of the economic drivers.
Julie, we're running out of time. What lessons should be learned, or have you learnt just from door knocking those thousands of people?
One, that you have to door knock.
Yes.
No, that if you want.
Well, you've got in as a result. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think politicians get out of touch in the way that people think. I think you get out of touch because if you stay in your office, you get people on their worst day of their life. You know, they've just been evicted, they're about to be deported, the electricity's been cut off, or because they have great passion.
Yeah.
But what you don't see in your office is people, is the trend of people's ordinary lives, the trends that show up over time. And so you, as a member of parliament, you must get out there and talk to people just as they're living their normal lives. And if I don't do it for a week, I feel out of touch.
And the trend is that people are increasingly in financial difficulty.
The trend is absolutely that when it comes to the economics of the family, that the economy as a whole may be going gangbusters if you look at the big figures, but when you look at the economy of the family, which plays out over a lifetime, it's becoming more and more and more difficult. And the things that people are having to do to make the economy of the family work, like work alternate hours, work longer hours, you know, both parents work longer than they'd like to, you know, is actually impacting on the family, on the social side of the family, in a very real way. And the pressures on people trying to raise children, you know, the pressure, you know, the financial pressure on the one hand and the absolute need to be good parents and good partners on the other, are absolutely in conflict at the moment.
We've been talking with Julie Owens. She's the Labor MP for Parramatta. She's knocked more of Howard Battlers than any other person in the country. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you.
No, thank you very much. We'll be back.
Bye-bye.
Tony Miller, he's the founder of Dads in Distress, a self-help program that saved hundreds and thousands, indeed, of lives around the country. Tony, you got some good news we gave it.
G'day, mate. Yes, we have. Yeah, we finally, the Minister has announced yesterday that we've achieved our, we put in 9 applications in local answers funding. We got 3 up, so we got nearly $750,000 out of that funding round.
$750,000.
So we're out.
Not bad. Hey, what about us? Remember us.
I'm remembering you, mate.
Congratulations, Tony.
Poor cousins over here on the radio. Yeah.
Hey. It sounds an enormous amount of money, but in reality, mate, we're not much better off.
All right.
What we were. It sounds an enormous amount, but what it is for a project in Victoria,
yeah.
Our existing project to keep that one going. One in Western Sydney, which is wonderful, which will enable us to employ somebody down in Western Sydney and get Western Sydney going. So that's your area, mate.
That's we broadcast from Western Sydney. Just we're running very much out of time. Just yep. Quickly, what is the Western Sydney thing?
And it's a project for the Western Sydney to expand the DIDS groups throughout that area.
Right.
You know, and to offer more services in that particular area, you know, and to network with the organisations around that area. And then we also got Coffs Harbour up, so. You know, it's great. I think it's recognition that this government has recognised what Dads in Distress is about and what we do, but in turn also recognises dads everywhere. So, I think that's a major plus.
Yeah, that's great. A big step forward.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a long way to go, mate, but I'm really pleased that we're there, and it just means that we're able to exist. I mean, it was a matter of days before we'd be out and cut. So,
would have been really a huge loss to the community. Mate. Huge loss to the community that would have been, and you were saved. That's good news.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's great. Who was the minister responsible?
Mal Ruff.
There you go.
Go Mal.
So that's where we're at this stage, mate. And as I said, when we actually do the number crunching, when it comes back to what we do up here, it's still going to be a tough road. But we'll continue.
We're out of time, Tony. Okay. Sorry. We'll be back next week. I've got an interesting show next week. Of course, we'll be back.
That's on the air. Here 'cause we care. We ask.